So I'll start with some announcements for those of you here in person. And so we'll start our practice discussions tomorrow. And the way they work is that we'll see half of you tomorrow, and the other half of you the next day. So we call that one full cycle. And there'll be two of those cycles, so they'll be repeated on Thursday and Friday. There's a sign-up sheet now for those practice discussions. They're down on the big doors going into the dining room. And it's signing up for... There's two sheets. One sheet says Tuesday and Thursday, and the other one says Wednesday and Friday. And sign up for only one slot between those two sheets. And when you'll see that when you're signing up, you're signing up to meet with a teacher in the first cycle, and then parentheses, which teacher you're signing up for the second cycle. So there's three teachers, but only two cycles. So you won't see everyone between now and Friday, each teacher. But then on Saturday, there'll be another sign-up sheet where you have an option, hopefully, to meet with the likely that you can meet with the teacher you didn't see, the third teacher. So by, say, 8 o'clock this evening, we would like everyone to have signed up on that sheet. And so you have to make sure that you don't sign up at a time when it's your work meditation and or bell ringing or something like that. And so you're only doing one sign up because some people will see, well, there's two sheets, so one on each sheet, or there's three teachers, so one's for each teacher. It's very creative. But write your name down only once. And thank you. We look forward to seeing you quite a bit. And then I'm still the supervising teacher for these two wonderful teachers here with whom we're here with. And so I'll be sitting in on every day. I'll sit in on three practice discussions that they will be having with three of you. So just know I will announce as we go along when that is. But so some of you will see me as that way as well. So the other announcement has to do with the fireside chat that we do. And we started that a few years ago to support the people who are new to retreats. It's kind of a big deal to come on these silent retreats, for if you've never been on one before. It's so strange. I mean, to be around so many people and you walk by them and they look down at the ground, or you bring your oatmeal to the table and sit down, and everyone's there already, and you sit in the empty seat, and no one looks up. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is bad news out in the world. But it's not really bad news here. But our subconscious system kind of doesn't get used to it, and not talking. And I've known people who have gone running from retreat centers screaming because of the silence. But then by the end of the retreat, they loved it. They didn't want the silence to end. So we want to just kind of meet with people who are new to retreats or newish, or people who are new to IRC retreats. Sometimes that's also, it's different here than other places. And so we hope that kind of it's an informal gathering for you. That's why we call it fireside chat. I guess, I don't know who's the fire. Maybe we're the teachers of the fire. You sit around us. And you come close, and we sit kind of casually, informally, and kind of break the trance of the retreat a little bit. So that's at 7:15 for those of you who would like to come. So the theme, as Don so wonderfully presented yesterday, is the seven factors of awakening. And this word awakening is a very evocative metaphor for what we're doing here. It's comes from the idea of waking up from sleep or waking up from a dream. And many people live in a kind of dream state in daily life. They get along fine. They can drive their car and not have accidents too easily. So it's not exactly like that kind of dream where you're living in an alternate reality exactly. But the level of projections, the level of conceiving, the level of bias, the level of preferences, the way in which we see through the lens of all kinds of opinions and stories and histories and constructs of the mind is quite phenomenal. And some people discover that they've been living a fantasy. And I once fell in love with a woman who I'd never talked to for 3 months. So it was a glorious relationship. And then I heard her talk, and she had a foreign accent. And I realized my whole fantasy was based on her being an American. And then I realized I had no idea who this person was, but I had created a whole fantasy. We were married and and divorced. And so, you know, so this ability we have of living in these stories, and then it's very sad when we project on them or when those stories are painful and oppressive. It's said that one of the leading causes of depression is rumination. And rumination often is, you know, story making, sometimes about how terrible things are, how terrible we are, or something. And so to wake up, to awaken out of the dreams, or awake out of sleep, awake out of kind of a dullness, or going through the motions of life, and just kind of being numb and kind of dull, just like not inspired, not so happy about how things are, but just doing what has to be done to get through, and maybe just, you know, doing things to distract oneself so we don't have to really face life and see how it really is or see ourselves in some deep way. But to wake up, to be awake, to have a clarity, to have be refreshed, to be vitalized in our sense of purpose, vitalized in our sense of value and what we put our energy into and what we feel our life is about and what we want to do and how we meet other people and how, you know, so that our very engagement in life is deeply meaningful, deeply satisfying, deeply free of the hindrances, the clingings, the resistances, the fears that many times keeps people in check. And to be awake is to no longer be held in check by our hearts no longer kept in check, our creativity, our intelligence, our feeling of how we can live our life. And it's a phenomenal thing to be awake this way. But it's not easy. The forces we're up against to try to become free are challenging. To wake up is challenging. There's a lot of forces in our society that are kind of, if not encouraging, at least kind of a condition for becoming numb, becoming shut down, becoming going into distraction, being in fantasy, living stories that other people tell, and then that's how we see the world through the stories that we've been told. I think of a lot of politics as some of these politicians are really skilled storytellers. mean, skilled in the sense that a lot of people get on the bandwagon with them and start seeing the world through the lens of those stories. And so it's hard when society doesn't support being awake, doesn't support the values that come out of being really attentive in a deep way to ourselves, to others, that we touch into the depth of our humanity and the depth of the humanity of others. The humanity of people are so much, you know, lost or denied or not recognized. So to wake up, the seven factors of this process of waking up. The Buddha contrasted the seven factors awakening with the five hindrances. The five hindrances, or five obstacles, are the five forces in our own mind that hinder our capacity to be awake, that keep us asleep or keep us in a dream, or keep us numb and shut down. The hindrances are the obstacles that have to do with clinging, grasping, attachment, that keep us from being free. And the direction the hindrances take us, if they're minor hindrances, maybe then you won't get in too much in trouble. But when they're really strong, some of these hindrances are devastating. It ruins lives. The addiction to alcohol, for example, or ill will can destroy not only oneself, but can destroy other lives. And we see it at play in society all the time. People have this tremendous hostility and hatred, and they're killing people some places. So the hindrances can take us and our families and our communities into the wrong direction. And in contrast to the hindrance, the Buddha offered the seven factors of awakening. And these do the opposite. They remove the hindrances. They remove the obstacles. They move us in the direction of freedom, of a certain kind of, I would say, is emotional, psychological, spiritual health. When who we are as a human being can operate in harmony, a sense of unification, harmony, well-being, where nothing is held in check. Our energies, our vitality, our faculties are all there to help us be more and more awake, more present for this life as it is now. So the Buddha put a lot of emphasis on these two factors, to overcome one and to grow the other one, to let the other one flower and grow. We don't construct the seven factors of awakening. It's not an engineering project. The Buddha used natural metaphors for describing it, like a plant that grows. We can fertilize the plant, we can water the plant, but we can't tug on it to grow faster. So we have these beautiful seeds. Each of us has the seeds or the seedlings inside of us of the seven factors of awakening. And so we're talking on this retreat, enhancing or growing something that each of you have. Something which in Buddhism is considered to be a treasure. It's kind of like the crown jewels of Buddhism are these seven factors of awakening. And they reside inside of each of us. Many people don't know they have them and have never occurred to them to let them grow and develop and bring a certain vitality to their lives. So mindfulness, investigation, effort, energy, courage, thrill, joy, rapture, ecstasy sometimes, tranquility, samadhi, and equanimity. So as I was thinking about this today, I'm also thinking about my father who died recently. And it's valuable for me to remember, review our life we had together and think about him these days. It seems like an important part of my life is to kind of remember those. So I go for walks and remember stories, events. So I was doing that today and thinking about a talk. So I spent a lot of time on the ocean with my father. He spent a lot of time on the ocean sailing, probably most years, 3 months of the year sailing. And he would sail his boats. It was kind of like he was trying to sail around the world. So he did that for 44 years. He tried to sail around the world with all kinds of side trips. And then four times he lost a ship at sea. And so then he would go back to the beginning, get a new boat. He was always surprised that the insurance companies kept paying for the new boat. At some point they should stop. But then he would start again and trying to make his way. And so I think he lost three boats in the Pacific. One of the boats that he lost in the Pacific, South Pacific, he was sailing into an island that had a reef around it. And there was a gap in the reef. The reef is kind of like a shoal of coral that's around the outside of the island. And then there's a lagoon, or there's water inside of it. But the reef keeps the inside waters quiet and peaceful, protects the island from big waves and things. But outside the reef, it could be big waves and all kinds of things happening out there. So he was sailing to go to that opening, to go through the reef. But his thing is, his engine had stopped operating. The boat had an engine and a sail, boat and a sail. But the engine had broken, so he had no engine to help him out. So he was just going to, he was a skilled sailor, so he was going to sail right in. But then as he got close to the reefs and close to where he was supposed to go in, but before he could get to it, the wind died. No motor and no wind means that you're at the mercy now of the sea. And the currents and the waves were all pushing him against the reef. And there was no way that he could stop that from happening. So the boat crashed up against the reef and broke up, and they had to somehow get off the boat and make their way to the calm side of the reef and to the island. So the seven factors of awakening are like the wind that fills your sails, that carries you along. But the hindrances are the waves that push you against the reef, that take over. And if you allow the waves to take control of your boat, it's not going to be a pretty picture. But if you can allow the sails to fill with the wind, then you can sail out of danger, out of harm's way. And so the seven factors of awakening are the wind that fills our sails. And to fill your sails, you have to know how to position the boat. Because there can be a wind that blows you right up against the reef too. But you have to know how to use the wind, how to fill the sails so it can propel you away from the reef, away from the danger. And that's what sailors learn to do. And they learn when to sail, when not to sail, what to do. I was once in a howling storm. I mean, I don't know what kind of storm it was, but it was out in the middle of the Atlantic, far from land, and the waves were 20, 30 feet high, I think. There were just massive waves above the mast of the sailboat. And we had the sails up a little bit and sailing along, and to smack into a big wave. I mean, the sound it makes on the boat is just horrendous. Like the boat's going to break, and then you fall off the waves, and that's a big bang and jolt, and it's a terrible thing. But then then you take the sails down, and you don't have any momentum. You just completely sit still, Well, you don't sit still, but and then you just bop up and down. So I remember we pulled the sails down and went into the cabin, and it was so peaceful and tranquil. And we would go up on these big waves, and we'd go down, but there was no falling over them anymore or banging into them. And that winds howled through this mast, but you know there was no danger anymore. We should go up and down. So sometimes we have our sails up, sometimes down. But knowing how to use our sails so that we know how to be safe and find our way is part of mindfulness practice. And mindfulness, the first of these seven factors of awakening, it has a lot to do with how you position yourself in relationship to the winds of life. Life will come with lots of winds, lots of challenges, lots of joys, lots of things. But how do you position yourself to it in relationship to it? And the idea is to position yourself in such a way that your vitality, your lived feeling of being alive, it feels like your sails are full. A full sail propels the boat forward a very nice way. It's wonderful to be in a boat and feel the when the wind comes along and fills the sails, and off the boat goes. And then in sailing language, there's a what's called the fluff. The fluff of a sail is what when the when there's the sail doesn't catch the wind. And so it just kind of flops around, or even sometimes blows the wrong direction. And so you have to kind of get the no have no try to have no fluff at all to get the maximum kind of movement. So mindfulness is positioning ourselves to catch the wind. And what's that wind? So mindfulness is one thing. The practice of mindfulness is something else. And the way the word for practice is used is it's a Pali word called satipatthana. And one of the meanings of patthana is related to take to stand, and to some place where you stand. So here I am, here. As Dawn said, you know, she called the word here as a kind of represents mindfulness. Here I am. So to take a kind of a stand or position yourself, I'm really here. And Buddhism glorifies here in many. There's these beautiful sutras that, and that in Mahayana especially, that talk about here. And then sometimes they talk about it that wherever you're sitting, whatever chair or seat, anywhere, that's your Bodhimanda. And Bodhimanda means the place of awakening. The Buddha sat under the Bodhi tree. That was his Bodhimanda. So the equivalent for you under the Bodhi tree is wherever you're sitting. So the celebration that you're here, this place, this time, now, this, you know. So position you. So of course you're here, but mindfulness is to position yourself here, so that you're really inhabiting this place with a sense of purpose, maybe, or a sense of value, a sense of worth, a sense of fullness, sense of engagement with here. Here I am. Here, this is the place to be. The contrast is to be caught up in desires, aversions, fantasies that have nothing to do with here and now. To be living in resentments of what happened years ago. To be living in desires and fantasies about what you can do instead of being here at the retreat. I mean, I shouldn't even mention the idea with the Santa Cruz boardwalk and a Dharma talk during a retreat. But it might be safe the first day. You know, there's roller coasters. There's rooms full of kids screaming and yelling around bowling pins and haunted houses and jungle gyms and you name it. It's an exciting place. What a contrast to this. So there can be desires operating that take us outside, and all kinds of reasons, but to come here, to really be here, to position ourselves like you would position a sail, you have to really get in here. In addition to that, sometimes there's been the idea that it's not just being here, but mindfulness is also to stand close. Be close to what's happening here. Be close to yourself. Be close to your breathing. Be close to your feelings. And if the feelings are too difficult or the pain is too difficult, then at least stand facing it, even if you have to do some distance. Just standing close, being here. And I think of it as accompaniment. That mindfulness practice is a practice of being your companion, accompanying what's happening in your life. And what represents that for me the most is, I have a friend who's having a hard time, and it happened yesterday. I was with someone who was having a very hard time, and a lot of people were trying to fix this person. No shortage of suggestions from people, and the person was a little bit, didn't quite know herself what to do, and so was kind of like swayed by everybody's ideas. And I thought, this is not my place to suggest, or I don't think that's what's needed here. What's needed is I'll just accompany her. Be her companion. We'll go for a walk and hear what's going on. Let her speak and let her talk about what's happening. So I accompanied her. She told me all kinds of things, how it was going and her challenges. I kind of said something like, well, I don't really feel like this was a time to make any suggestions. I just felt like I wanted to just be with you as you were. And she said, thank you. You're the only, she said something like, a lot of people are trying to help me, but with you, I just feel that your love. So I thought that was kind of nice to hear. So maybe that was, I don't know if it was more important than helping, but that certainly, I think I, as a principle, I like people to love me rather than to help me. I don't know how you guys are, but the love-help equation. Balance. So it's just accompanying. I accompanied her. And so to accompany ourselves that way, with love, with care, as if we're important. To be with our breathing when you meditate is to accompany ourselves, to accompany the breathing. Maybe with love. If you think that you're trying to help your breathing or help yourself, maybe there's something inside that feels not quite as good as if what's inside feels that you're just be there to love what's here, but to accompany. And what I feel is significant about the word or the idea of accompaniment, that's what we do first and foremost. But you can't accompany without having attention. If we say first and foremost, be attentive, have attention, be aware, it's kind of hard sometimes to stay aware. Some of you probably accidentally noticed that your mind wandered off. We weren't planning on it, but somehow, once or twice today. But it's hard to be sometimes stay aware. But maybe it's easier, the idea of, let's accompany this. And if you accompany your breathing, accompany your embodied experience, accompany the present moment, accompany here, what follows with that is awareness, attention. You're attending, you're here, because you have to accompany well. So to stand near, to stand with, And to stand with something, also colloquially in English, sometimes means that you're standing there to support something, or stand to be their friend, or be their companion, or be their supporter, or be their kind of, to take a stand with them means you take their position with them. So to take a stand with yourself, be with yourself and feel it and sense it. So the mindfulness practice is to show up for our experience here, not somewhere else, not tomorrow. And then what mindfulness is not so clear exactly what it is. And maybe now you'll leave because I'm a mindfulness teacher for so many years and I don't quite know what I'm talking about. Isn't that outrageous? But there's no shortage of trying to learn what it is. I've probably spent a lot of time thinking about this, looking at the text. But it kind of is something a little bit more amorphous, just like the word awareness is amorphous. What does it mean to be aware? You know, and I once asked someone, a group of people, how do you know you're aware? And I wasn't prepared for the answers. There were so many different answers. It meant so many different things for different people. And I said, wow, Gil, you better be careful. As a Dharma teacher, I keep using the word awareness like everyone knows what I mean. my understanding. But in fact, I know people are hearing it differently because they have so many different reference points for what it means to be aware. So what does it mean for you to be aware? And I ask that question of you, so you're curious. So you get interested. How are you aware? And are you always aware the same way? And when are you aware one way, and when are you aware a different way? It's such an amazingly precious resource you have to be aware. We need to be aware of everything that's good in life. There has to be awareness for it to occur, for it to flower, it to be there. There's nothing good that comes from life without being real, without being aware, waking up. So how are you aware? So I'll give you some options. I call it the different attentional faculties. We have different faculties for attention. So there could be sense knowing. We can know by seeing. We could know by hearing. We can be aware because we hear something. Smelling, tasting. There's tactile. We touch something. Something touches us, and we feel it and sense it. There's a lot of physical sensations that arise in the body, sometimes stimulated by what's inside of us, not by what's outside. And so there's sensing of our whole body. And this is such an important part of the Dharma, to sense and feel it through all our senses. The way I was taught mindfulness in Burma, it was a sensory awareness exercise. It was awakening all our senses, physical senses, and really staying right there in the perceptions, the feelings, the senses as they were stimulated and as they kind of did their dance of different things. So that's one way to know, is to feel the senses as they. Another way to know is cognitively. You can feel the body being warm, and then you can know that's warm. Oh, that's really warm. That's hot. I think I have a fever. we can recognize and know cognitively. And this is actually a very important part of mindfulness, is to allow the natural capacity for cognition to operate. Not self-consciously, not forcefully, but a relaxed and open and present mind will naturally have cognition. Sometimes it's nonverbal cognition. We know what's happening. We recognize what's happening. And we recognize things without thinking about them, but there's some recognition of it. When you leave a room, you don't try to go through the wall, most of us. We recognize the door. And we don't think about the door. We didn't plan for the door to be there. Or, you know, we just like, that's almost sub-vocal that we recognize the door and we know operate. But there's still a cognition of it. And we know what the door is for. The way that I was trained in Burma also, there was big emphasis on sensory awareness. And there was an emphasis that the way to support us to be mindful of the sense world, as that all the senses happening, was to use cognition a little bit emphatically. It was called a mental note. So if we were breathing in and inhaling and the chest or the belly expanded, we would say rising. That's what we're told to do. Then when we exhale, falling. And we just kind of, or if we heard a sound, hearing, or a dog barking or something, just a very simple note. And some people use the notes a little bit like a checklist approach. Did that check, which doesn't work so well. But what I found really helpful is I would use this very soft mind, very quiet, peaceful mind, as quiet as I could find available. And I would say, as I was breathing in, the inhale, but the in was not the purpose of saying in. The purpose was to kind of like open a door of awareness. In was like the beginning of the story. In. Now, what's this experience of inhaling like? Out. It was kind of like almost like I was opening myself. Okay, now let's feel the exhale. Sound. Not just sound and then onto something else that did that, but sound. Oh, what's that? So to attend to each thing, to stand close to each thing that occurs, to allow ourselves to experience each thing, to accompany what's there. The mental note, if you use it, it's just telling us what you're going to accompany for a few seconds or minutes or something. Here, this. And then, because it was a sensory awareness exercise we did back in Burma, it was the cognition would be here, something, and then it was like open to, okay, let's feel, what does it feel like now? A representation of how that was in Burma was so we sometimes had monsoon rains, and I was indoors. Sometimes the rains would start, would go to 0 to 60 in 0.1 seconds. I mean, it would just like suddenly, just like deluge of water would come on the roof. And without any warning. And when that happened, I would immediately go into my body to feel what has shifted now. All my sense doors. Has anything shifted and changed with the air pressure, with the humidity level, with the, I don't know what. And I got so curious to open up, what's this experience like? It wasn't just rain. It was like, oh, rain. What is this like? So mindfulness is giving ourselves time. It's best when you do mindfulness practice to do it with the idea you have all the time in the world. There's no hurry to be here for this experience. For now. What's this like? To accompany, what is asking to be accompanied? So there's a senses, there is cognition that knows what something is. And the quieter and stiller the mind is, when the mind gets really concentrated, still and quiet, that's when the cognition factor becomes more important. Just the knowing, oh, knowing what it is, just know it. And knowing has no force and no assertiveness and knowing doesn't interfere with anything. It just knows. Another thing that the tradition emphasizes, the Buddha emphasizes, is our capacity to observe. So even with the eyes closed, you know, there's a kind of, we have a sense we're observing what's happening. And that's a kind of different way of knowing. It's not sensing exactly, but it's kind of settling back and a little bit from a distance, looking down or watching what's happening or allowing yourself to perceive in some deeper way, this is what's happening. This is what's happening. And so it's kind of the mind's eye almost that we're watching. And that can feel quite lovely. That's what's operating with cognition, with awareness. Sometimes we can feel like we're aware from the mind. Sometimes we're feeling aware from the body. Sometimes it seems like the heart is what knows what's happening. So the location of where we feel we're aware from can change. Sometimes awareness is the way we attend to attention can feel active, like we're actively engaged in being aware. And sometimes it feels like we're being receptive and passive, and sometimes deciding. Some people find that being the actively engaged in being aware, just they love that. It's just a good feeling. It keeps them there, staying in the present moment. Some people find that the active mode doesn't work well for them. They just tie themselves in knots when they try to do something. And it's better for them to get into a receptive mode and knowing receptively. Just allow everything just to appear and show itself to you rather than going to the breath. Let the breath come to you. One is not right or wrong, but it's all these different ways in which we engage in this process of mindfulness. And I don't want to give you all these things to make you busy, but what I'm trying to do is to suggest, to help you get curious, what do you do when you're aware? And the hope is here on the retreat that you are consciously aware more often through the day than you are in ordinary life. And the expression consciously aware is a very significant expression. We can be aware, but not so conscious of anything. You can be having this furious argument with a friend and you're walking in the park and you don't even remember that you stepped over a rock or avoided a puddle because you know you're so involved with the argument. So you're something was aware of the puddle or the rock, but you weren't consciously aware, like, oh, I know that's a rock, kind of, or that, you know, just like the feeling like I'm here with the rock. So they have consciously aware. And here in the retreat, we're trying to increase how much of the day we're consciously aware. And when you're consciously aware, how are you aware? When you're walking down the steps, if you take the steps, what awareness is activated when you're walking down the steps? Are you using your eyes at all? Probably a little bit. Are you using the sensations of your feet against the floor to feel where the step is and to feel maybe where the edge of the step is and so you don't go, you know, you put your foot in the right place? Are you curious about the texture of the rug against your feet? Maybe some of you are barefoot going down because your shoes are downstairs so you can feel the rug. Part of your attention is alert. Is there anybody going to be walking up the steps? And how do you have to adjust yourself and move a little bit so to make space for the person to walk up? Or are you not consciously aware? I've left the meditation hall here, and by the time I get to the bottom of the steps to put on my shoes, I realize I wasn't there for the steps. The steps got pretty lonely that day. Gil doesn't care for me. Because I was already thinking something, and I was lost in my thoughts, involved in my thoughts. And so then there was an absence of conscious awareness. So to see how this works, and start appreciating conscious awareness, appreciate positioning yourself here for your experience. There might be sometimes a feeling like taking, you know, really taking your seat or taking a stand. Okay, I'm here with this. Okay, this is what's happening today. Okay, I'm going to be here with it. And maybe even there is a kind of even reorientation. Okay, I'm going to really be with it and look directly, stare down. Or, you know, I think what's happening here doesn't want to be, to be seen so directly. But like my friend I walked with yesterday, I think the idea of looking at each other while we were talking probably wouldn't have been so good. It was, you know, not looking at each other, taking this walk and talking about very important things that was allowed for a certain kind of accompaniment and closeness that probably wouldn't have happened if there was two, you know, sat looking at each other. So what about you? How do you accompany yourself, and how do you position yourself to stay close or stay connected or stay aware to what's happening? And at some point, as you get curious about what conscious awareness is for you, you might discover that you're consciously aware without intending to be. That you're consciously aware without the effort and the work to do it. And then what's happening is you started to catch, your sails have started to catch the wind. And at some point there's a momentum, the wind becomes stronger, and the wind of awareness, the wind of presence, the wind of being here. And it becomes, at some point, you feel the momentum of being here, like something in you wants to be here. Something in you wants to stay aware, be in the present moment. It's actually more satisfying to be in the present moment than it is to wander off in thoughts. And so at some point, and that's when it starts becoming a mindfulness factor of awakening, an awareness factor of awakening. And when awareness is the wind that you've caught, that's propelling you. And the wind is not exactly personal, it's not exactly you, it's not you and what you do, but it's part of you, you know, it's not somebody else's mindfulness, awareness. But it starts having its own life, it has its own strength, its own momentum, its own, you know, it starts operating sometimes in a very powerful way without you being the doer of it. And it begins when you begin allowing for that or let it to grow when you get first curious about how you're aware. So that you become, just that makes you consciously aware. It's a little trick. And then whenever you can remember, come back to conscious awareness. Stay close to it. Give time for it. Give time to feel the sensory experience of things. Be here to know cognitively the simplest possible way what the present moment experience is, the kind of knowing that does not involve a story, just an act of recognition. Maybe lingering with observing, settling back and just seeing what's happening as it unfolds, allowing it to unfold without interference. And then at some point you'll begin feeling, wow, I just had a conscious moment of conscious awareness and I didn't do it. How did that happen? And that's the beginning of catching the wind. Stay there. Let that keep, you know, what that happens a little bit. Yeah, trust that. Allow for it. Stay close to that. Don't switch around and act, be the doer now. Okay, I'm going to do it better. That doesn't, you know, just, okay. Okay, let me now be careful here. Let's not mess it up. But you have to stay present. You have to stay there with it. So sometimes we accompany accompaniment. We accompany ourselves being aware. So you might see if this idea of accompaniment gives you a little different feeling or sense for what mindfulness can be than maybe some of you have practiced for a long time, and maybe it's the kind of offering it this way gives you a little different door into being here fully enough that the wind of mindfulness begins to fill your sails. And then you feel the momentum of your practice is not something you are causing, but you have to keep yourself positioned to allow the sail to be full, to move you along through the Dharma ocean. So thank you. And thank you for accompanying each other on this journey for this week. I think it's very significant that we are doing this together. Thank you.